Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, a budget deal, a Volcker rule, mourning Mandela, a spy in Iran, a dead uncle in North Korea, and remembering Sandy Hook. Republican Paul Ryan and Democrat Patty Murray hammered out a budget deal. There's grumbling all over, but no shutdown. Here's Murray.
We have broken through the partisanship and the gridlock and reached a bipartisan budget compromise that will prevent a government shutdown in January.
A week of mourning worldwide and in Soweto for Nelson Mandela. In that big stadium, here was South Africa's retired Anglican bishop, Desmond Tutu.
We promise God that we are going to follow the example of Nelson Mandela.
And many marking the anniversary of an unbearable killing of children and teachers at Sandy Hook Elementary here yesterday in Washington's National Cathedral. This hour, On Point, our weekly news roundtable, with Nancy Cordes of CBS News, Michael Hirsch of National Journal, and On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Are you glad for a budget deal? Do you still want a battle? And what are you thinking on our missing man in Iran, Mandela, Pope Francis, Sandy Hook? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us now from Washington is Nancy Cordes, congressional correspondent for CBS News. Nancy Cordes, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Also with us from Washington is Michael Hirsch, chief correspondent for National Journal. Michael Hirsch, welcome back to you as well.
Glad to be here, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beattie joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Nancy, and Michael.
Nancy, let's come straight to you. Congress has the budget deal. It's big, it's small, it's modest, it matters. What do we have here, Nancy?
What we have is a small deal in numbers. I mean, basically, they set out the budget for next year and the year after that. This is no grand bargain that dramatically cuts the debt or tackles entitlements or deals with tax increases. They were simply trying to get back to regular order where you have the two sides agreeing on a budget so they can fund the government for a year at a time, get away from this terrible cycle where we only fund the government for a few months and then we have shutdowns and showdowns all the time. What upsets some conservative groups in particular is that they say, look, we had a big opportunity. We had leverage here to try to get big cuts to the deficit, and we didn't get it. And that's why a lot of the conservative groups are opposing it. But I think that after the shutdown, both sides were just really weary of a battle that went nowhere. We're really looking for some kind of compromise, and that's why it won big in the House and is probably going to pass in the Senate next week.
So Senate next week to the president's desk, I assume he'll sign, and we'll have, what, a couple of years of regular order on the budget front?
That's right. This bill would set the budget right between what Democrats and Republicans wanted. Imagine that. It took them that long to get to a deal that basically splits the difference. Right above $1 trillion a year for fiscal year 2014 and 2015. And what bothered Democrats was that this deal doesn't do anything to tackle long-term unemployment benefits, which are scheduled to run out at the end of this year. And now the House has gone home, so they can't do anything about it until January at the earliest. So that's really left hanging out there, which they think is, you know, really a big, sort of a Scrooge move here heading into the holidays.
Just a titch over $1 trillion. And that, as they say, is serious money before the vote on the Ryan-Murray deal. Paul Ryan talked about it. Republican congressman, of course, big leader on the budget front for the GOP, called the bill a firm step in the right direction.
The bottom line is this first step is designed to help improve people's lives. It's designed to make this government work at a basic functioning level. And by passing this, we will reduce the deficit. We came here to get something done. We always lock horns. We always argue. We never agree. I think it's about time, for once in a long time, we find common ground and agree. And that is what this bill does.
Michael Hirsch, common ground. It sounds like we're in a foreign country here. Does it change the mood in Washington, or is this just a temporary reprieve from all that?
Well, it is a temporary reprieve for policymakers and legislators in Washington. What this opens the door wide to is really a furious civil war that until the other day was only simmering below the surface before the Ryan Murray deal was announced, but is now out in the open. You've had the extraordinary spectacle of House Speaker John Boehner, who only back in October was seen essentially as a tool of the Tea Party base of the Republican Party, repudiate the groups, the very conservative groups like Heritage Foundation that have come out against this deal, saying they're without credibility. Quite, you know, striking language from him. And so what we now have is essentially the Republican establishment in open warfare with the Republican base. And we're going to have to see how that plays out, particularly leading up to the 2014 election, to determine whether there really has been permanent damage done to this very, very hostile base that is opposed to this deal, that is opposed to any kind of compromise at all.
And boy, was that interesting yesterday when the House Speaker John Boehner had that moment after all these weeks and months when you could tell he was up against it, but holding it in. Yesterday, he did not, reacting with visible frustration. He was asked at a press conference about conservative groups that pushed for a fight over Obamacare back in October, eventually ending in a government shutdown. You can hear more than that kind of bubbling here and then breaking out from the speaker. Listen.
They pushed us into this fight to defund Obamacare and to shut down the government. Most of you know, my members know, that wasn't exactly the strategy that I had in mind. But if you'll recall, the day before the government reopened, one of the people, one of these groups, stood up and said, well, we never really thought it would work. Are you kidding me?
Are you kidding me? And that, to my ear anyway, Nancy Cordes, sounded like a lot of frustration honed down to just this one point at this one moment. But that's something new to see from John Boehner in public.
Yep, he clearly wanted to get some things off of his chest. In fact, I was really surprised. It was the day before when I just sort of set out to ask him a pretty innocent question. You know, there are a lot of conservative groups that are opposing this plan. What do you think about that? And he just jumped in and said, oh, you mean the groups that started bashing it before they even read it? And I said, oh, yeah, those groups. And he said, well, I think they've lost all of their credibility. You know, he really went after them. And this is really a big moment. I mean, imagine if Nancy Pelosi came out and told the unions and MoveOn.org to take a hike and that they'd lost all of their credibility. That's kind of, you know, the equivalent here. But for Speaker Boehner, he feels as if these groups have worked against him this year even more than the Democrats have, that they have urged conservative members to block almost everything that he has tried to do because they feel that it's not sufficiently conservative. And I think these groups themselves are almost a little bit surprised by how much power and sway they have over the conservative base in Congress. And so this is Speaker Boehner sensing some weakness here, sensing that, you know, he kind of had the upper hand with this particular budget deal. Conservatives didn't want to go along with these conservative groups. They wanted to vote yes. And he decided that now was the time to pounce, try to recapture some of the power that they had taken away from him.
Jack, I want to hear you on this, but here's the sound of the conservatives. This was Republican Congressman Tim Hulskamp of Kansas talking with Larry Kudlow on CNBC. Here we go.
I understand with the speaker getting upset, but the truth is this, Mr. Speaker and others, this is a spending increase in the next 2 years, which is why the Democrats have signed on to it.
But the word from John Boehner yesterday, right here.
Are you kidding me?
Jack Beattie, what do you make of that moment, Jack?
Well, you know, I don't really see what Mr. Hulskamp is complaining about. This budget is a triumph for conservatism. I mean, consider this. The sequester, which is the residue of the Budget Act of 2011, cuts the deficit, cuts spending by $960 billion over a decade. This deal just reached trims that by only $63 billion. $63 billion out of $960 billion. That's a 6.6% cut. What is the cut in? Well, it's in job training, it's in education, it's in housing, it's in FBI, it's in Veterans Affairs, it's in infrastructure, it's in all the accounts that could make a difference to Americans in their daily lives. All the accounts that could begin to deal with this vast inequality problem that the president talked about just a week ago. And now the Democratic Party has signed on to this, signed on to a level of discretionary spending that is even lower than in the Ryan budget, which they were decrying as draconian and austerity and so on. Now they have signed on to that. And, you know, while doing this with discretionary spending, they have done nothing about the accounts that in, you know, the CBO says within 3 or 4 years are going to start really boosting the deficit, namely the entitlement programs. Not touched at all. They've done exactly the wrong thing economically. This still puts a fiscal drag on the economy. And more, you know, in terms of policy and social mobility, this is this budget, this agreement is a disaster.
Michael Hirsch, what about it? The fiscal hawks want more. The Tea Party moans. But has this, in effect, set the needle on spending deep in GOP territory?
Unquestionably. I mean, I completely agree with the assessment just made. The Republicans have still largely won the fiscal battle and will continue to win it. And I think that is part of the frustration of Boehner and the Republican leadership is they feel that they've put themselves out on a limb. They cast, you know, dark shadows over the Republican Party because of its unpopularity over the shutdown, particularly in the wake of the horrible rollout of Obamacare and all the embarrassment that caused the president, which, of course, was obscured by what happened during the shutdown. So there's a sense that, you know, by Boehner, let us do this our way. We're winning the battle. You know, you guys on the conservative side and the base are getting plenty here, and stop complaining. Maybe I think that's basically it.
Maybe that's part of this from John Boehner.
Are you kidding me?
You're getting plenty, guys. Maybe that's what he's saying right there. Michael Hirsch with National Journal, please stand by. Nancy Cordes with CBS News. Jack Beatty, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Looking at a week in the news, a budget deal, a woman to lead GM, Mandela mourned an execution in North Korea, and many, everybody really, remembering Sandy Hook Elementary and what happened there a year ago tomorrow. Michael Hirsch is here, chief correspondent for National Journal, joins us from Washington. Nancy Cordes is congressional correspondent for CBS News, joins us, and Jack Beatty's here as well. Let's go to our listeners, Duncan in Fort Campbell, Kentucky. Duncan, thanks for calling. You're on.
Hi, Tom. I love your show. I just wanted to say that for Congress to be lauding themselves about coming to an agreement to do people's business is really embarrassing. They were elected to execute the mission of acting in the best interest of the nation and sacrifice that for political ideology and, most importantly, ideological purity. That's just really embarrassing.
You might say so. So are you happy for a deal or not, though, Duncan, on balance?
I'm happy that they got to a deal, but it's really embarrassing that it took a government shutdown and a thrashing in the polls and an impending election for them to get out of their seats and do something productive.
Yeah, Duncan, we've got it loud and clear, though. It's funny because it's, you know, it all depends on who's saying what's embarrassing these days. You got Tea Party people saying this is embarrassing. Nancy Pelosi saying it's embarrassing that we don't have an extension on unemployment benefits. But I take your point, and many feel just that way. Jason in Columbus, Georgia. Jason, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, Tom.
Yes.
I just wanted to say, you know, the only way to totally end this budget nightmare is to basically vote both parties out of office. I mean, the Democrats caved to the Republicans with no new tax increases on the wealthy, and there's still the same budget cuts that are in place. I mean, how is that any kind of a budget deal that's going to keep us out of, get us out of the situation we're in now?
You mean economically, that's kind of Jack Beatty's point right there. Point taken. And one more here, Jared in Columbia, South Carolina. Jared, you're on.
Yes, sir. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I just think that the theme everybody should take from this is bipartisanship. Each party accuses the other of not having it. A deal was reached. Not everybody is going to be able to get their side completely done. And if I could just comment on the Sandy Hook situation, I think that when these mass shootings happen, for the gun sales to increase is a message that, you know, majority of the country would rather have their guns with this happening occasionally than to get rid of the guns.
Boy, if you're right, that's really something to ponder. But you may be right, Jared. I mean, just on the facts, you'd have to say so right now anyway. Nancy, let me come to you on the point that Jared made there about bipartisanship. What's the reality here? Is it the reality that most people want everybody to get together and get something done? Or is the reality that we're this 50-50 nation and people would rather have a fight? What's real here? People asserting both of those things this week.
Well, the problem is we are a 50-50 nation, but that members of Congress sometimes are even farther apart than the rest of the nation. And so they have trouble performing these basic duties like passing a budget. That's almost one of the most basic things Congress has to do. So your callers are right. They shouldn't be applauded and cheered for finally, after 4.5 years, getting around to passing a bipartisan budget. On the other hand, sometimes they're so far apart that trying to find a middle ground is almost impossible. It's not as simple as saying, you know, how much do you want to raise the budget by? How much do you want to raise it by? And we'll meet in the middle. One party wants to dramatically decrease the budget. One party wants to increase it. So meeting in the middle is difficult because, you know, Republicans will say, well, we don't want to increase the budget at all. So, you know, we're not going to go for anything that does that. And that just makes finding middle ground very difficult, not just on this issue, but on all kinds of issues that Congress is dealing with right now, like tax reform and immigration. And, you know, the two sides are, you know, there's such a wide gulf and there's so little trust. And that is one area where I think that this deal does help, is that the level of trust was, you know, was so low. And the faith in leaders to be able to make deals, since these deals had fallen apart so many times before, was incredibly low. And finally, you have these leaders, Paul Ryan and Patty Murray, sitting down for 2 months negotiating, not a big deal, but just, you know, scaling back their expectations, trying to do something small just to prove, hey, look, we can do this.
On another front where there's been division and there was maybe a breakthrough this week, Michael Hurst, the new Volcker rule that's out there. We had Gary Gensler on not long ago, the outgoing chair of the Commodities Future Trading Commission. He pushed for a tough Volcker rule, of course, named after Paul Volcker, who was head of the Fed back in the early 80s. Much respected guy. This is to keep banks from using their money for their own plays in the middle of market time. Here was a commissioner. This is Bart Chilton from the CFTC telling CNBC's Squawk Box that this newly unveiled rule, barring banks from trading for their own gain, is a good thing.
I think it's a really rigorous rule that's good, that it does exactly what the law said. I mean, it stops the wild flyer bets that are just for the house. It will allow legitimate hedging activity for legitimate business risk, but it has to be defined what this business risk is. And so I think ultimately it's going to be, you know, good.
What do you think, Michael? Is this a leash back on the banks on this front? Or, you know, when he drops in there, oh, it will allow for legitimate hedging activity. Americans have come to understand that that could mean anything. Is this tough regulation or just right or too little?
Well, I'll tell you what, Tom. I was glad you did that show on Gary Gensler because he truly is, you know, one of the unsung heroes, I think, of this whole post-crisis period, because it was he, along with a few other chief regulators, who fought against those kinds of loopholes that would allow the big banks to claim, you know, that was really risk-taking, just a trade for their own gain, was actually hedging. That was a very critical fight in the final stages of this, propelled by the news about the so-called London Whale, where, you know, you had J.P. Morgan, this blue-chip bank that took $6.5 billion worth of losses in a trade that they claimed was legitimate hedging but was really just massive risk-taking. And what the Volcker Rule is really what we have that is the closest thing to the Glass-Steagall Act of 1933. Mm-hmm. This was really the inspiration for Paul Volcker, the former Fed chairman who first proposed this way back in 2009, was ignored for a while by the Obama administration until the president finally realized that maybe it was a good idea. This is Volcker's way, this is the government's way of saying to the biggest banks, you cannot take, you know, federally insured deposits, in other words, taxpayer-insured deposits, the cheap lending you get at the Federal Reserve's discount window, and just use that to gamble, like in a casino or like you're a hedge fund. You can't behave that way. And, it remains to be seen. I mean, there's going to be no doubt lawsuits from some of the big banks to try to hold up this rule. Its implementation has been delayed till 2015. But I would say that potentially this has more impact than almost any other rule that came out of the Dodd-Frank financial reform law to really restrain the biggest banks on Wall Street. It's a very impressive achievement.
Let's take our attention abroad for just a second. Several fronts there that are really interesting. The one that just flooded over the airwaves as yesterday moved on was out of North Korea. Here was the official announcement. North Korea, always with that sound, but that's the state media out of North Korea announcing last night that Supreme Leader Kim Jong-un, only 30 years old, just a couple of years in power there, had executed his uncle, Jang San-taek, who had been a very important official, right next to his elbow, kind of his advisor, the older advisor, dead and gone now. Michael Hirsch, how are people interpreting this? Is this a sign of strength from the North Korean leadership? Is this a sign of a regime in trouble? What's the read on this execution? And is there more of a purge to follow?
Well, I'll preface it by saying, anything we say about North Korea is speculation, at best informed speculation. But most of the experts seem to believe that this is evidence of weakness of Kim Jong-un, that this is an extraordinary spectacle. We haven't seen this since the late 50s, where someone's at such a high level, literally right next to the supreme leader there, is taken off and executed like this. It suggests, and indeed the statement from KCNA, the North Korean news agency yesterday, suggested that there was a widespread conspiracy. So you can expect to see a purge continuing. You can expect that a lot of senior North Korean officials these days are not sleeping particularly well. And we don't know what will come of this. We do know that it suggests a long-term turmoil and instability in a nuclear-armed country. And so that's a cause for concern.
Nancy Curtis, what are you hearing? A couple of things that have emerged. One was that he had this uncle, now dead, executed, had been in charge of some kind of interest in economic change or reform. Another, that he had often acted as the conduit to Beijing, a very important player, of course, in North Korea's life. What about potential? I mean, does it just look like this young leader did not want the shadow of an older uncle over his shoulder? Or are you hearing interpretations here that say, oh, this was a policy issue somehow, Nancy?
I think, a lot of members of Congress and frankly the White House are still trying to figure out what to make of this very violent action. The White House came out and said, if this is true, then this is another example of extreme brutality. But beyond that, they said, we're following developments and we're consulting with our allies and our partners and trying to figure out what's going on. So I think, obviously, North Korea doesn't have a very high standing in the U.S. Congress. It certainly isn't going to change. But I think there was even greater concern this week about what to do about Iran, about what to do in the situation with the situation in Syria, where Congress feels that it has more of a role to play. The question is, even if even if members of Congress were concerned about what was happening in North Korea, what can they do about it?
We'll get to those, Jack. How about North Korea? I mean, here it is nuclear armed. It's right across from our ally, South Korea. It always makes you nervous. And then here comes an execution, which looks like something out of the 1970s or the 970s, Jack.
It sure does. Or the 1930s in Russia. People used to describe plenum meetings in Moscow where everyone would get up to applaud Stalin and no one would dare be the first person to even move to sit down.
Yeah.
And they would just keep applauding and keep applauding. And finally, Stalin would sit down, but he'd watch them all. And sure enough, one of the uncle's offensives here is a half-hearted applause.
Yeah.
I mean, so, there we are. We're right back to the communist, ultraism.
Clap harder, you're out. I will not soon forget that video of him being taken right out of that big meeting by uniformed officials just in the middle of things. Now he's gone. Let's turn to Iran. Really interesting there. Of course, John Kerry trying to negotiate toward a step down of their nuclear program. Plenty of people on Capitol Hill saying, no, let's step up the sanctions instead. Here was Kerry testifying before the House Foreign Affairs Committee on Tuesday, warning Congress against stepping in with new sanctions.
We're asking you to give our negotiators and our experts the time and the space to do their jobs. And that includes asking you, while we negotiate, that you hold off imposing new sanctions.
Nancy Cordes, what are the odds of that? Is Congress chomping at the bit to get in there with tougher sanctions, or will Kerry keep them cool, calm, collected while this thing plays out?
There are some members who are chomping at the bit. There are Democrats and Republicans who say, you know, we can't trust Iran. We don't trust this deal. We need to impose some new sanctions just so that they're hanging over Iran's head if they walk away from the deal or if they don't fulfill their end of the bargain. But the trick here is that it's actually not up to the big Foreign Affairs Committee to decide whether we impose new sanctions on Iran. It's up to the banking committees. Mm-hmm. And right now it appears that Secretary Kerry does have them on his side. They have agreed, at least for now, to hold off on trying to put new legislation together that would impose new sanctions on Iran. And you know, even if they wanted to do something, the House is now gone for the year. The Senate will be leaving shortly. So it doesn't look like anything will happen in the next few weeks. This is really a delicate balance right here. So we could see things change in January. I don't think that this issue has gone away, but nothing's going to happen right now.
And Michael Hirsch, Nancy raises Syria. Take us there. It was kind of stunning news this week that jihadi Islamists, the sort of Sunni tough guys in Syria have raided big warehouse or warehouses full of supplies that Western countries, including the United States, had been supplying to the Free Syrian Army, the kind of moderate opposition there in Syria. We heard that the top general there, Idris, was not even in the country, that he'd flown out to Qatar. And it had the appearance of moderate opposition in Syria, those backed by the West having kind of collapsed this week. Is that too much, Michael?
No, sadly, I don't really think it's too harsh an assessment. We don't know for sure, but the trend lines are unmistakable. Of course, the U.S. and the West responded by suspending non-lethal aid of the kind that was seized at these warehouses. What you now have is a sort of very weak secular front, the Free Syrian Army, that appears to have less and less power. You have a united front of non-Al-Qaeda, or at least so proclaimed, groups that still want to form an Islamic State. And then you have the super jihadist, I mean, ultra jihadist groups like al-Nusra, which do proclaim an affiliation with Al-Qaeda. And among those Islamic groups appear to be most of the military threat to the Bashar al-Assad regime. So the United States, you know, finds itself in the almost impossible position of opposing the Assad regime and Assad's continuation in power, and yet increasingly facing up to the likelihood that if he is ousted, Syria will become something of an Islamic State, which we don't want either. And this, you know, does appear to vindicate President Obama's hesitation over aiding the Syrian rebels over these last 2 years, which has been somewhat controversial. He's caught a lot of criticism from the Republicans over that. But on the battlefield, we see that the Assad regime, the Syrian army, aided by Hezbollah, which in turn is aided by Iran, has really made huge inroads. And that's a very, very scary situation there right now.
Jack, validating President Obama for his hesitation? I mean, the critics say, should have done more, should have been in there. Look, it's a flop.
Well, imagine what they would have been saying if this, say, there had been, man pads in there, you know, those things they shoot off your shoulder that knock down a plane, or tanks. In other words, if we'd been giving
supplied by the U.S., yeah.
Yes, and that's what the Joint Chiefs, Hillary Clinton, the CIA, they were all saying to the president last year, we go ahead and do this.
But maybe Idris would have been winning. Maybe the Free Syrian Army would have booted, the Assad regime out. Maybe we'd have paradise breaking out there in the Levant.
That's a counterfactual. We'll never have the answer to. What we do know is that there are now 5,000 Sunni foreign fighters in Syria, more than 1,000 of them from the West. That's more foreign fighters than were in Afghanistan in the 80s, and we know all the trouble that came out of that.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, no end to the protest in Ukraine against President Viktor Yanukovych there and his move away from Europe and toward Moscow. Here on Wednesday, thousands cheered as riot police failed to remove them from the center of Kiev. Pope Francis is Time magazine's Person of the Year. Some conservatives not so happy with the Pope right now. Vatican spokesman Reverend Federico Lombardi said it was good news about the Person of the Year cover.
The Pope is a person that does not look for success or for honors. But if this declaration of the Man of the Year means that many people have understood his message of the love of God for all, and then it is good news and he will be happy.
And Golden Globe nominations are out. American Hustle and 12 Years a Slave tied at the top with 7 each, including a Best Actor nomination for Chiwetel Ejiofor, who plays in 12 Years a Slave, a free man sold into slavery.
I will not fall into despair. I will offer up my talents to Master Ford. I will keep myself hardy till freedom is opportune.
It is a moving piece of cinema. We're looking at a week in the news, budget deal, woman to lead GM, Mandela mourned, and more with Nancy Cordes, congressional correspondent for CBS News. Michael Hirsch is here, chief correspondent for National Journal. Jack Beatty's here. Here was President Obama on Tuesday speaking at the memorial service of Nelson Mandela in Soweto, outside Johannesburg.
Nelson Mandela reminds us that it always seems impossible until it is done. South Africa shows that is true. South Africa shows we can change, that we can choose a world defined not by our differences, but by our common hopes. We can choose a world defined not by conflict, but by peace and justice and opportunity.
There was a lot of high language and high honor given to Nelson Mandela this week. Michael Hirsch, how does this resonate? I mean, here was a guy who... a man, a hero to many, who was a guiding light for the good stuff, for an awful lot of people in this world. Now he's gone. What goes with him? What sticks around?
Well, I'll tell you, I think in many respects, Mandela was the last great global leader in the mm-hmm. sense that he did set standards, as Obama suggested. The anti-apartheid movement that he led while still in prison was in some ways the last global social justice movement that was successful. Mandela set an extraordinary standard for not only enduring the brutality of a 27-year imprisonment, but particularly for the way he behaved afterwards, embracing his enemies in a way that that you know. People found really, really extraordinary, and that brought together South Africa as a country. And so I think it was appropriate that you had this sort of global presence. I mean, basically three U.S. presidents, including the current one, along with many other world leaders. It was really an extraordinary 95-year-old life, and I don't think it was any accident that Obama, in his initial remarks after Mandela's death, sort of echoed what Lincoln's Secretary of War had said after Lincoln was assassinated, that now he belongs to the ages. Obama said something very similar about Mandela.
Jack, what were your thoughts in the middle of all the praise and remembrance this week on Mandela? And interesting that Pope Francis, with his message, should make the cover of Time this week as Person of the Year. Is there, I don't mean to say mantle shifting, but here's another leader emerging as a, for many, moral leader at the same time that Mandela is waved off.
Yes, and in the case of a pope, as with Mandela, a moral leader transcending his own institution. With Mandela, it was transcending the, you know, black against white of the freedom struggle, and going to be a biracial leader and insisting on that constitution and so on. And with the pope, it's transcending an institution that has been, as he says, the pope says, obsessed with pelvic issues and losing sight of social justice. And someone Kevin pointed out that in a recent homily or exhortation, he used the word abortion twice and mercy 30 times. So that seems to be the shift in the with the Pope, and he could well be a successor, that world figure that Michael was talking about. But you know, I thought with Mandela, the point that Nick Kristof raised this week really got me, that all this high talk, but if you're going to live the Mandela message, you got to put human rights first. And he notes that just the day that Mandela died, Chuck Hagel was, where was he? In Bahrain, cozying up to that minority regime there. And, you know, you could say, well, we have interests. But the other point that Kristof makes is, you know, we really ought to get on the right side of history. Inevitably, these regimes go down, and then the people that we have spurned come up, and we have no connection with them at all, so that human rights actually is not only quite consistent with realpolitik, it's realpolitik in the long run. And the other point he made is that Mandela is a lot, you know, lived throughout that period, partly because of world pressure back in the 60s. They wanted to execute him, and in the face of world pressure, they sentenced him to life in prison.
I mean, let's remember, U.S. leaders stood in opposition to Nelson Mandela and what he stood for a long, long time. I mean, Nancy, interesting this week, you know, while all of that sort of hymns and praises of glory going on, we get the news out of Yemen that a U.S., apparently U.S. drone strike there hit a wedding convoy. You know, they thought it was Al-Qaeda militants, but Yemenis say no, it was 14 killed here and many more, injured, 9 more critically and 22 in total. Wrong target. It's not exactly Mandela style, Nancy.
It's not, but I do like to think that his legacy and the stories that we heard this week did have some impact on Congress. You know, hearing those stories about how he forgave and befriended his jailer and about how he worked with F.W. de Klerk, you know, it sends a message to leaders here. Look, you know, you guys can work together, too. You can put some of the rancor behind you. And I did sense that, you know, there was this renewed interest in wanting to be part of something bipartisan, in wanting to work together. And, you know, even though a lot of people weren't thrilled with this budget deal, for example, at the end of the day, they did seem to feel good about the fact that the two sides had been able to hammer out a compromise.
Let's take a caller from Osceola, Iowa. Momo's calling. Hi, Momo, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yes. Yeah. So my comment has been that, you know, all this time, during the Mandela passing, and he said, I'm originally from Nigeria, by the way.
Yes.
I was surprised to learn that at one time, Reagan actually had opposed sanctions against the apartheid regime. He had opposed America moving. And also at a certain time that the CIA played a role, you know, when Mandela was arrested, that they gave a tip, you know, to have him arrested.
At the beginning of his 27-year imprisonment, yes.
Yes, yes, at that time. So what I'm surprised that has been lacking, you know, in all this coverage is how America had moved from that, you know, from that angle. And, you know, what caused the change? Why did they because I never knew of this, and I'm sure a lot of people, you know, don't know. What happened? How did America move from that position, you know, of labeling him a terrorist to, you know, and how they moved to this position, the transition, how, I don't know what happened.
Yeah, yeah, Momo, I appreciate your call. Jack, you can probably answer that as well as anyone. I mean, I do think it's important in this week when we celebrate Mandela for his message of forgiveness to remember that he also fought. I mean, he fought all his life for the right, for freedom, for black Africans to stand up and participate in a real democracy. He was not exactly forgiving deep wrongs. He was extending forgiveness to let society move forward. But he fought against wrongs. Momo asks about that evolution in American policy from more or less standing with the apartheid regime to actively opposing it. That built on the backs of a lot of people who stood up to say, we don't want this anymore, Jack.
Yes, I mean, I think the context of it is the Cold War. I mean, you know, the CIA giving that tip to the South African security forces. Mandela was at one point either thought to be a communist or a communist. Well, that was enough for our people. And of course, as people have pointed out, it was the communist governments that provided weaponry to the violent wing of the ANC over the years. And then for us, of course, as the Cold War waned in the late 80s, in the mid-80s, Congress was able to take the initiative away from the executive and to legislate a change and to legislate sanctions led by Ted Kennedy in the Senate, Ron Dellums in the House, others. They were able to force that on the Reagan administration. And they were responding, Congress was, to the real perception out there in the world that something had to be done, that this regime just couldn't go on the way it was. Essentially, a Nazi regime with Nazi ideology well into the 20th century. It had to stop. And people were arguing, well, sanctions won't work. They did work. It's the sanctions that made them take him out of jail. That's what they were shut out of the world economy.
Michael, I hear you there.
One more piece to that. Obviously, the shifting sentiment, which Jack describes accurately, was driven by what I referred to earlier as this incredibly successful global social justice movement, which was appearing on college campuses at the time. I myself was involved, actually. I was a graduate student at Columbia University.
Was that you in handcuffs there, Michael?
not exactly, but we were there and we were chanting Free Mandela, and it so happened I was also covering it for the Associated Press. But the fact is that these movements were enormously powerful. And yes, as the sentiment of the Cold War began to shift more toward detente in the latter half of the 70s, or rather the 80s, you saw this divestment from South Africa movement really pick up speed. And Mandela went from being a suspected communist in the Cold War sense to increasingly an international hero. And it happened very quickly. And the impact of this on Congress and the shifting sentiment in Congress was enormous.
It may be hard for young people to remember or understand how deep that sentiment was all over the place on consumer purchases. I remember as a young man going out to buy an engagement ring and being so determined to find one that was not mined out of South Africa in those days. People didn't want to buy South African products because that anti-apartheid movement, the social justice movement, was strong. Nancy, I can't let that whole scene go without remembering for just a moment that wild story of the interpreter, so-called or supposed interpreter for the deaf at the speeches there in the great stadium in Soweto, who turned out just to be doing mumbo-jumbo, just kind of jiving there and signing nothing right next to the President of the United States, just for starters, Nancy.
Right. And I think it was Jay Leno who joked, you know, we've got an NSA that knows everything about all of us. And yet somehow a man with a violent past who's been arrested, who's schizophrenic, is allowed 18 inches away from the president of the United States. How could that happen? And I think that that's a question that a lot of people legitimately are asking.
A lot of deaf people offended by that. We won't forget those images for a long time. Joe in Marfa, Texas is calling. Joe, you're on the air. What do you see, my friend?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
GM, $11 billion they didn't pay back. Where's my money? I worked for 47 years. I live in $1,463 a month in Social Security. I paid for 47 years. Now, how come nobody's talking about that?
What if it saved jobs, Joe? Does that make you feel better or not?
I do the same thing, but again, but I want my $11 billion back. What is? They're making billions of dollars. There's not a peep in Congress and their administration about
that. Yeah, that deal done. We got it. That money gone now. Books closed on that on the American side of the border anyway. Nancy, moaning about that on Capitol Hill? Or is that history? Never mind. Off we go.
There weren't too many people who were talking about it this week, frankly. I think maybe they were absorbed with the budget talks and certainly people were glad to see that they were turning the page at GM. So, you know, I completely hear his point. But there are a lot of folks who are sort of looking at the big scandals of today, things like Obamacare, and that's where a lot of the attention is right now.
Woman at the head of GM, boy, there's history turning a page. Alita in Normal, Illinois. Alita, thanks for calling. Great to hear from you. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just was also remembering Sandy Hook,
yes,
and being
of a liberal bent. I would really like to see universal health care coverage, but maybe the place to start is universal mental health coverage, not to, you know, to have the goal of, like, setting up a database necessarily, although that could be an outgrowth of it, but more to actually help people, you know, reduce gun suicides, which are very high, and also, you know, any kind of, you know, hopefully to be able to identify those individuals that really do need help and provide it for them.
Yeah, Alita, point taken, and a good point in this week. Gun control certainly did not happen overall out of that terrible shooting. Lots of talk about mental health. Just for a moment, let us remember, this was Monday. Family members of some of those 26 victims, 20 little children, gathered to remember those they had lost.
Our family will be lighting a candle on the eve of 12/14, the last night we spent with our sweet Charlotte.
And we will be lighting a candle for our beautiful little girl, Jessica.
We will be lighting a candle on behalf of Jesse McCord Lewis.
It just tears your heart out. Here we are a year later. Nancy Cordes, Alita says, let's do something practical. If it's not going to be gun reform, what about universal mental health coverage? Do you see any national response to this after all the gnashing of teeth and rending of cloth and all the rest, Nancy, at the end of this year?
I think it does have more support, the idea of improving mental health coverage, improving mental health reporting, care. But the problem is that it hasn't risen to the top of the agenda the way that some other issues have. And that has really slowed the progress. And, of course, it's a very difficult subject to tackle, very sensitive, and members have different ideas about what they think the best thing is to do.
Jack, we only have a second, but it's almost in our backyard here, and the woe just so deep and the numbers so unbearable of those deaths.
Oh, and the grief, just unimaginable for any parent, and the sense that we, that is the country collectively, has failed them in mental health, failed them for sure in guns.
That remains a standing challenge. Jack Beattie, thank you so much for being with us this week. Michael Hirsch with National Journal. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you.
And Nancy Cordes at CBS News. Thanks so much for joining us, Nancy.
Great to be with you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.